Russian President Vladimir Putin repeats his call for security guarantees from the West as he blames the U.S.-led NATO for escalating tensions over Ukraine. Iran's President Raisi says a principled policy of his country is to support the stability and sovereignty of neighboring Iraq. Palestinians hold a funeral for a young man who was killed by Israeli soldiers in Ramallah on Wednesday. I'm Behrouz Najaf. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin stressing that the West should give security guarantees to his country as tensions go on over Ukraine.
Our reactions will depend not on the negotiation process, but on the unconditional security of Russia. We've made it clear and explicitly that further NATO movement is where it's unacceptable. What's unclear? Is it us who places the missiles near the USA borders? No, it was the USA who came with its missiles to our house. They're on the doorstep of our house. You're demanding some guarantees from me. It is you who must give us the guarantees. You. Immediately. Now.
Now Putin says Russia's security is threatened by Ukraine's growing ties with the Western military alliance. He says that NATO has cheated Russia with five waves of expansion since the Cold War. The U.S. and NATO accuse Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow strongly denies that and plans talks with the U.S. and NATO early next year in order to defuse the tensions. In the press briefing, the Russian president also spoke about a gas crisis in Europe. He said it's unfair to blame Moscow for the crisis, as the Russian company Gazprom is meeting its obligations.
They lie all the time. They mix everything up. Gazprom supplies all the requisite gas volumes under current contracts. And not only that, but it's also increasing the volume by 12%, I guess, or around 20% of supplies far abroad and to Europe.
Well, Putin says that he suspects some Russian gas pipe to Germany was ultimately being resold to Ukraine. He added that Europe is stuck on long-term contracts and has created its own gas problems. The continent is grappling with record-breaking natural gas prices and a strong winter demand. Some analysts blame the spike on simmering tensions with Russia. That's the key supplier. Journalist and political commentator Fred Ware believes that the West is recognizing that it has pushed NATO's eastward expansion too far and is seeking dialogue with Moscow.
There's a war of words going on right now. You need to look past the rhetoric, the purple clouds of who's threatening whom, and see that they have agreed to talk. And the mood, both in the United States and in NATO, I think is much more congenial than it was in years past. I think everybody recognizes that they pushed NATO expansion too far. They have a case of indigestion, I mean, of a geostrategic nature. And also that they realize that Russia has rebounded. It's not the Russia of the 1990s anymore. It's a much stronger, more unified, and economically resilient place. It's got its deep security concerns. It's always had them. It isn't something new. It has never liked NATO expansion. The thought of Ukraine joining NATO has always made Russians see it plots before their eyes. It's just that now a strong Russia is drawing a line. And it also may have something to do with the fact that the United States in particular has shown itself to be strategically incoherent and incapable.
Now, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi tells the Iraqi foreign minister that a principal policy of Iran is to support the stability and the sovereignty of Iraq. Raisi was speaking with Fuad Hussein here in Tehran. He said that Iran views insecurity in neighboring Iraq as insecurity on Iranian soil. He also hailed the resistance of the Iraqi people and said that's the main reason making American forces leave the Arab country. The president said that once the U.S. enters a country, it does not leave unless it faces popular resistance. The United States has used the language of threat against Iran again, a familiar and outdated phrase called other options used interchangeably with all options. Many analysts argue that a look at Iran's massive military exercises involving new weaponry, hardware, and modern techniques should make Washington think twice before making a military threat.
The United States has stepped up its anti-Iran rhetoric, threatening Iran with, quote, other options if negotiations in the Austrian capital fail to restore the 2015 agreement. The threatening language was made by the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley. He warned of a period of escalating crisis if diplomacy failed to restore the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The remarks came days after negotiators from Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA concluded the seventh round of talks in Vienna, aimed at bringing the U.S. back into compliance with the agreement by removing its sanctions against Iran. Malley referred to Iran's retaliatory measures within the JCPOA framework and said, if they continue at their current pace, we have some weeks left to restore the 2015 deal, but not much more than that, at which point the conclusion will be that there is no deal to be revived. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the window is rapidly closing to save the 2015 agreement and that Washington is exploring other options.
U.S. government is very much aware of this fact that the U.S. Army, the broad masses of Americans, don't want another war. We have just gotten out of Afghanistan after 20 years. Finally, things are perhaps coming to a close in Iraq as well, and so to, you know, within under a year, go back into Eurasia, go back into also the Arab world, and start another war would be absolutely disastrous.
Blinken claimed Iran's nuclear advances are making it increasingly problematic to return to the 2015 agreement. It is getting very, very, very short, being able to recover the full benefits of the JCPOA by returning to compliance with it is getting increasingly problematic by the advances that Iran makes every single day in its nuclear program. This is while the Vienna talks have taken a break after Iran and the IAEA reached an agreement for the agency to install its cameras at the Karaj nuclear facility, a point insisted by the parties to the talk. Iran also agreed to this as a goodwill gesture. Antony Blinken also blamed the former administration of Donald Trump for the worst decision made in American foreign policy in the last decade by withdrawing from the deal in 2018.
The U.S. military threats against Iran pale next to the number of times Israel has military threats in the country. Not only has Tel Aviv been a loud opponent to the Vienna talks and the removing the sanctions, it's even said that it would attack Iran and target its nuclear facilities with or without an agreement. Many observers, though, believe that such an attack can only take place with a green light from Washington.
The threatening language against Iran comes amid ongoing talks to revive the deal, which was abandoned by the United States in 2018 under the administration of the former President Donald Trump. Israel has opposed efforts to revive the 2015 deal, which lifted sanctions on Tehran in exchange for curbs on its nuclear program. It has continued to threaten direct military action against Iranian nuclear facilities.
We've seen historically with U.S. presidents, U.S. administrations, that when approval ratings are very, very low, it's common for a president to start a war and attempt to secure a second term. And so Biden, who is experiencing record low approval ratings, may be seeing that as his only option for re-election.
There are some reports that Israel may be preparing for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, but former Israeli officials have admitted that Tel Aviv regime is not capable of taking out Iran's nuclear program. Israeli military officials have also cast doubt on the Israeli military's capabilities to destroy all of Iran's nuclear facilities.
So if Israel wanted to take on Iran, because Israel most certainly couldn't do it on its own for a variety of reasons, I think the most significant being Iran would, you know, for lack of better terminology, Iran would wipe the floor with Israel and with the IDF. They would need U.S. support, and Israel can basically yank the chain of the U.S. government and the international media apparatuses and say, you know, we want war, we want the propaganda coming out. And the U.S. and the U.S. media, the global media, and the global financial institutions are going to do whatever Israel says.
Iran has warned Israel against any wrong move. The top IRGC official has said any aggression by Israel against Iran would not be possible without the U.S. giving its approval. If such threats are implemented, the Islamic Republic's armed forces will mount thrashing attacks against all centers, bases, paths, and spaces used to enable the violation and against the origins of the violation. Iran has held massive drills in the southern provinces to increase its preparation for any scenario. In the exercises, the IRGC forces showcase their latest capabilities and military hardware, including an advanced homegrown tank dubbed Karar.
Ryan Bovanani, Iranian foreign minister, is saying that his country, in a serious manner, continued talks with the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Iran will do that until negotiations result in a good agreement.
The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. On the whole, we did not see the position of some European countries as very constructive, specifically that of France. In the latest round of talks, the three European countries practically presented no new initiatives.
The official also said that Tehran rejects this approach, that the other parties offer one concession to get several in turn. Tehran, the remaining JCPOA members, have held seven rounds of talks in Vienna this year to resolve outstanding issues over the 2015 deal. Those issues began after the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018, reinstating sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran rolled back its commitments a year later. Iran says it will fully meet its obligations only after the U.S. removes the sanctions. Vienna will host a new round of negotiations by the JCPOA members next week. Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man who was killed by Israeli fire a day before. A mourning procession was held in Ramallah in the Akbar West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammed Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is critical of new Israeli rules that give soldiers more freedom to use deadly force. It says the rules are further proof of the Israeli military leaders' criminal behavior and terrorist policies that encourage the deliberate killing of innocent people. Israel has amended its open fire rules to allow soldiers to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones, even when they don't pose an imminent threat. From Ramallah, I'm joined by Mustafa Bakuti, who is with Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council. Good day with us, sir. So we've been watching this, especially in the past weeks, things are happening and more Palestinians are being killed. And as you just heard in the intro, there is this modification in the rule. They simply open fire on Palestinians who even do not pose any threat to Israeli soldiers. Why is this happening?
These are not isolated incidents. These are part of a strategy that the Israeli government is following. And it aims at suppressing any kind of Palestinian resistance or rejection of the Israeli plans to annex the West Bank. What is happening is that the Israeli army has decided to legalize committing war crimes against Palestinians, including shooting Palestinians even when they are representing no threat to anybody. And that the translation of that was the assassination of this young man, who was Mohammed Abbas, who was killed in Ramallah. But before that, they shot the car of another Palestinian, and they burned him alive inside that car. And these are incidents that keep repeating. In my opinion, what is happening is very dangerous because there is a serious shift in the Israeli establishment, not only to the right, but actually towards fascist behavior. And this shift is very much encouraged and supported and promoted by no less than 750,000 illegal settlers who are residing now in the West Bank and accelerating their attacks on the Palestinian people.
I appreciate your thoughts and comments, Mustafa Bakuti from Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council in Ramallah. That's why the World Food Program says it will reduce the food rations of 8 million Yemenis. It's suffering from a shortage of funds, and that's why the WFP already warned that the current level of hunger in Yemen is unprecedented and is causing severe hardship for millions of people there.
As millions of Yemenis face the threat of drowning into a famine due to the ongoing Saudi-led war on the country, the World Food Programme says it will reduce its food rations to 8 million people in Yemen starting next month due to a lack of funding. What the World Food Programme's done is a clear escalation against civilians and will primarily harm children and women who depend on humanitarian aid for their survival. The United Nations bears full responsibility because it's primarily responsible for humanitarian aid and it's supposed to protect civilians, not help international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis. The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe since the aid reaches only a very small number of people and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operating expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: المصيبة للصابر واحدة وللجازع اثنتان.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, the catastrophe is but a single one for the patient man and two for the anxious one.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So when talking about these interesting and beautiful dialogues and conversations of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that there's a very interesting story from when Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a small child. He was a little boy at the time. Now his father, the esteemed sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was sitting in a place, and Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam came to his father carrying a tablet. Now this tablet wasn't the tablet of nowadays, which is an electronic device. At that time, over 1,000 years ago, a tablet was a piece of stone on which things were written and recorded, or a piece of wood, for example. So Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam called Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam towards him and sat him on his lap and said to him, my little son, write, you will meet from your enemy all kinds of tricks. Then Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam said to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, complete this saying. So Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam, who again was just a small child at the time, he completed this saying in response to his father in this dialogue. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, if the enemy schemes and tricks against you, do not scheme and trick against him. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam became incredibly happy at the wise statement of his son, and he was happy and proud of the talents and the genius of this young child, this child by the name of Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam. So Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam embraced Imam Musa ibn Jafar, and showing his great admiration towards Musa ibn Jafar alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam, this infallible Imam, this Ma'soom, said, offspring one of the other, which in the Arabic culture is a form of admiration and pride. Now, what do we take away from this statement and this beautiful conversation, which shows that one infallible Imam started a tradition, and then the second infallible Imam to be finishes this tradition, where Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam says, you will face all kinds of tricks, deceptions, schemes, plots from your enemy. And in reply, Imam Musa ibn Jafar alayhi salam says that if the enemy schemes against you, they plot against you, they try to deceive you, they try to trick you, they try to, you know, manipulate you, which of course are all negative things. These are all the tools of the shayateen, the devils from among the men and the jinn, to use deception and to use trickery and evil schemes and evil plots and wicked plans. So if the enemy does this, Imam Musa ibn Jafar alayhi salam says, that does not mean that we should do the same against the enemy. Meaning, as Muslims, we are not allowed to make evil plots against the enemy. We are not allowed to make wicked schemes against the enemy. We're not allowed to trick and deceive the enemy in negative and devilish, satanic terms. We are honest. We are honorable. We are sincere. We are truthful. We are just. We are noble. Just as the seventh divinely appointed Imam has taught us in these beautiful conversations, this is dialogue, Imam Al-Qadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the seventh Shia Imam, is also known as Babul Hawaij, which means that the door to the desires and the hajat for us. This title became very famous for the Imam because of how he would attend to the people and respond to the people in Medina. It's been reported that Imam had two doors. One was a door was in the front and the door in the back. And usually the back door was always open to any time. Those whosoever have any need, have any desire, would attend to the Imam. And also it's been reported that after the sad martyrdom, after the sad shahada of the Imam, his chamber, his grave site, his shrine became the door of fulfillment of desires, and it stands as of today as well.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing US Election Day documentary 11-8-16. Produced and created by Jeff Deutschman. And joining me in the studio, we have Anna Smith, who is a film critic and broadcaster. She is also the president of the UK Critics Circle and a regular film critic for various mainstream channels. And beside her, we are also joined by Jonathan Fryer, who is a lecturer, broadcaster and freelance writer. Now, on the 8th of November 2016, Americans from all walks of life went to the ballot box to vote for their next president. Though little did they know at the time what would be in store for them, after most people believed that the country would be seeing its first female president be elected. This documentary, which features the work of many directors and film crews, follows a cross-section of Americans throughout that fateful day and shows the complex and diverse spectrum of opinions about their reasons for voting for Trump or for Clinton, or in some cases, not voting at all.
Days to election, I can update this. Did you vote today?
I voted early on
You did?
Friday.
Did it feel great?
Today, I'm going to vote for the first time in over 30 years.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm a little nervous about the outcome of the election, the future for the coal industry.
You can't stop doing politics. Knock on doors, say, hey, excuse me, did you vote today? Be polite. It's a beautiful day.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock. They'll call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? Not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Thank you.
I could feel eyes watching me as I walked through that crowd, like they hated me, like I was Donald Trump.
They say, you know, your vote may make a difference, but to me, I don't think so.
हम रहते हैं इस कंट्री में कमा के हम खाना खाते हैं पीछे अपने फैमिली की टेक केयर करते हैं तो आई प्रे अमेरिका लिव लॉन्ग एंड प्रॉस्पर
It looks like maybe we should be planning for the too close to call scenario where the Trump wins.
Now, the who we had as president, African Americans were still the lowest man on the totem pole.
See to shine in the sky.
There's hope. Never forget that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power.
From sea to shanty.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for both of you for coming on. Now, this documentary could be seen as quite a historic and invaluable piece of filmmaking, as it gives the world viewers an insight, sort of a window into the psyche of Americans voting that day and what they were thinking. And Anna, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you're right that it's an interesting snapshot of Americans, and it also has an emotive subject, a fascinating subject, which all great documentaries need, and what all great documentaries need as well is great characters. And this has lots of really strong characters, people who are voting from different sides, who strongly believe in what they're talking about, and the access to them on a day that is a very important day in their lives means that there's some explosive conversations and some very telling and revealing conversations. So broadly, I liked it.
That's a great opinion. And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna just said?
Yes, I mean, the technique of the documentary was really interesting. The producers called it a periscope view, with 16 periscopes popping up across all the way from New York over to Hawaii, even interviewing different families and individuals. And of course, it's fascinating because watching it, we know the outcome. But during the film itself, until right at the end, the actual voters are not aware of the outcome. But many of them are really, really engaged, as they either want to Hillary Clinton to win, as what was expected originally, or they're rooting for Trump. And it's fascinating to see how their mood changes, in some cases optimistically, in other ways, for other people, disastrously, as they see exactly what they didn't want to happen and literally are brought to tears.
Mm-hmm. And the dramatic irony of it, actually, is what makes the film so fascinating and relevant today to watch, actually. And I just want to talk about Jeff Dutchman's previous work. He made a similar film about Obama's election campaign and his supporters. And I bet we can imagine that probably had a different tone than compared to this film. What do you think, Anna?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very different, because of course it's fascinating. He goes about these films without knowing the outcome. But obviously people were much more optimistic about Obama winning, and this was a bit of a surprise result in this case. So it's fascinating to think that when he and all the directors involved, because he sort of curated this, and there were all these other directors.
And what a feat for filmmaking, actually. I wonder how difficult that must have been to coordinate.
Yeah, he sourced a lot of great filmmakers from all over the world who were very talented, and obviously a lot of them probably had a connection with their subjects, which gave rise to some very, very interesting people and subjects. But yeah, I mean, just watching it in retrospect then makes it particularly interesting, of course, because there is this sense of perhaps impending doom or success, depending on your point of view, that you just know is going to be a real shock to some people that you're watching. So it adds to the tension.
It was a great collaborative project indeed. And Jonathan, just quickly before we move on, if you could just take us back to that time, why was it so shocking for Trump to win? And in hindsight, is it actually that surprising?
He was an extraordinary candidate, and of course has become now a very extraordinary president, because he was absolutely not the normal run-of-the-mill politician. Basically, he was anti-politician. And so it was an enormous shock when he was elected. And everyone did expect, most people expected, Hillary Clinton would win. And I'm sure the director was thinking, right, but it didn't happen.
And it was much to everyone's surprise, actually.
So you are in the vast majority of the populace that does not vote. How are you feeling about that?
I feel pretty good. More than we are voting for any particular candidate, we are voting for the system. And it is a system that I just don't abide by. We don't need new legislation. We don't need a new politician. We don't need the Constitution to change to actually, like, care for our community. You just have to have the will. That's where I put my effort. I put my effort there because I think change comes from the work that we do, not from the ballot box.
My white people have always had the right to vote, right? Like, my lineage has always been, we've been the power, right? So what would you say to somebody who would be like, wait a minute, you're African-American?
You mean like my grandmother?
Yeah, like your grandmother.
As much as I really honor the nothing less than heroics that it took in order for African Americans to be able to vote, you know, getting the right to vote was the equivalent of walking into a room, a game of Monopoly was being played by all rich white men. The game was already in motion, property was already bought, hotels already built, and African Americans earned a right to sit at the table. They earned a right to sit at the table, start in jail, didn't collect $200, start off with no money, no property, nothing. that's a game you cannot win. It's about time that we walk in and wipe the whole damn game off the table and start over.
I think one of the most prominent issues this documentary exposes is the clear racial division in the US. Thinking back to the scene where we see in Chicago African Americans talking amongst themselves sort of the conflict they feel in having to choose between Trump or Clinton, and they say that Clinton obviously isn't the great candidate for them either, considering the whole super predator count scandal and the three strikes you're out sort of thing, and then Trump isn't so great on minorities either. Anna, could you just tell us, did this documentary, was it effective in exposing this racial divide and how complicated this issue is?
I think you're right, it is an extremely complicated issue, and it's very hard in the space of a documentary like this, especially with so many different people and so many different directors, to really get to the heart of the issue. But at the same time, it did touch on a lot of that, and it was very careful, I think, to have a variety of people from different sides and of different races talking about how they felt about it. And I thought the filmmakers succeeded in getting people to be very frank about racial issues, as we saw just there, and very articulate. So it was thought-provoking for me on that level. Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan, would you agree? Do you think this documentary exposed the divided nation?
Well, I think it really stressed the diversity rather than the division, the diversity of the American population, people who've been there for generations, some who are very new immigrants. It's interesting, it starts with a Sikh taxi driver who's clearly from a Punjabi family who probably very recent immigrants and rather excited by the idea that they will be able to vote. So in that sense, I think it's extremely valuable in showing the different races, ethnicities, religions, etc., that make up the United States. But without a doubt, some people very clearly in the film felt disenfranchised, even if they were able to vote. It's interesting, it ended with a very poor couple in Hawaii living in a tent in a park who basically sort of say, well, you know, okay, it was election, but what sort of difference is it going to make to our lives? Nothing whatsoever.
And I like how it came actually full circle to that point, actually, that some people are very helpless when it comes to politics and it doesn't make a difference to them. But I just want to talk about some statistics now. Data from the election actually shows that the majority of young white Americans, both male and female, under 44 years old, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas those mostly over 45 overwhelmingly voted for Trump. So Jonathan, why do you think Americans voted the way they did?
Well, there clearly was a very stark generational divide. It's rather interesting, we had a very similar phenomenon here in Britain in 2016 with a EU referendum in which 45 and over majority voted to leave the EU, 44 and younger voted to stay. So there clearly is something happening between the different generations. But what was really also very interesting about the statistics in the US election was that people outside the cities voted for Trump. It was sort of like a rural revolution of people, particularly older people who maybe had seen their hopes dashed for a brighter future and were therefore determined to go out and to make a protest, basically.
Well, we're lucky to have Jonathan here to give us political context to this. I was just quickly wondering, Anna, would you have liked for more political context to these stories?
I think it's also well publicised now that even the most casual observer of the news will know exactly what happened on that day and what the results were and what the ramifications would go on to be for the people that we see on camera. I found it interesting, as someone that doesn't necessarily follow every inch of the political news, to find out who, you know, the sort of makeup of the voters and the characters of the voters, because, and particularly the Trump voters, because you hear a lot about and see a lot about Trump himself, but to see who actually voted for him and then giving the reasons why, I found fascinating.
And of course, we actually learned that a lot of people who voted for Trump were scared to admit they voted for Trump. So it was only in the aftermath that we really found what was actually happening. I'm glad we got to see the sort of behind the scenes of the media rooms and them preparing for the election result. And they largely believed Clinton was going to win. Anna, what could we learn from the documentary about the role media or social media played in the election?
It was fascinating, wasn't it, that they felt that they kind of knew, I mean, they prepared for every scenario, but there was that confidence in the polls, which evidently was misplaced. So I think a lot of journalists could probably learn from that scenario from watching it. I certainly found it fascinating watching those journalists there sort of hedging their bets, but basically thinking that Hillary was going to win. In terms of people from all walks of life making assumptions based on what they see and hear. And also when you see people in this documentary watching the results come on screen, on their own TV screens, you just see how sheltered some of those people are on both sides and how little they understand about other people's opinions, and how we become, you know, even in social media, we only really follow people with a similar point of view, which isn't, social media is not really explored in this, but I think that's something that is a spring, sort of springboard for thinking about that.
Definitely. And look, it raises many questions, actually. And Jonathan, if I could put that question to you, what role do you think, actually, the media, indeed social media, played on the election?
Well, they have two different things, the mainstream media and the social media. The mainstream media, it was clear that most of them, with exceptions such as Fox News, were rooting for Hillary Clinton and firmly expected her to win, though obviously they had to make provision for a result of a different kind. Social media was an entirely different matter, because there, the Trumpers, if we can call them that, were really in the ascendant, and this is the first presidential election in the United States where social media had a huge impact. And Donald Trump himself has millions of followers, and whereas many people may say, well, a lot of what he tweets about on Twitter is rubbish or untrue, it has a huge effect, and he has that great following. And he, of course, despises the mainstream media, talks about fake news, because the liberal commentators on the LA Times and other newspapers, of course, are opposed to the sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label certain news channels fake news, and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news, and that's what you're going to put forward.
And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other points and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. Could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between one, the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump and he's really gung-ho, and to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know? I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
If she's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway, so I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right. And you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets.
Take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was kind of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting in what they don't personally actually really believe in. They're being swayed.
And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, I mean, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in which are really important. You know, there's tax, because Trump was saying he was going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. You know, one of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely that's a good thing.
Great. Of
Isn't
course,
that akin to
of
the
course
NHS
but the Trumpers, on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. A very interesting point made by a number of people during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote.
2.9%.
But she was more unpopular than Trump was.
And does that expose flaws, then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, which we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels, actually, between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow an American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously, Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though. The Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities. So I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually, indeed, as also that we can compare. And I suppose UK politics seems to be a bit more on the serious side, or perhaps not.
Well, it'd be very interesting. The next election, presumably, we will have Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party into an election campaign, and there'll be a big focus on, is this a man who can be Prime Minister? Is this a man who can lead Labour Party to victory? Because the opinion polls at the moment are saying more or less the Conservatives and Labour equal pegging, which is bizarre when the government is doing things which are frankly difficult to support. Why isn't the opposition miles ahead? Mm-hmm. So there's a ground for a real mystery there. So perhaps some documentary maker could already be plotting the election coverage documentary of Election Day, whenever it's going to be.
Perhaps. And just going back to the documentary, as we're near the end of this discussion now, actually, I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth a watch.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film?
When it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes. Am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters, in the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.